And this is the hour we call Conversations with Linda. So the phone lines are open, and we'll be back with you and her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Back in March of 2006, Linda Richard C. Hoagland talked about the red rain on the show, and his theory with the late Tom Van Flandern was tied into the exploded planet hypothesis. Possible? What do you think?
Tied into the exploded planet in what way?
Well, I think he thinks it might be part of the remnants of an exploded planet that has made its way down here.
Well, I don't know. There was a sonic boom, or at least a boom, that was heard in the July, August, September time period by residents in Kerala. And the boom sort of made some of the scientists think that maybe it was something like a meteorite or a comet coming in.
All right. That's interesting.
And the fact that the cells, when you
it's
talk about an exploding planet, you're talking about something that would have happened like 4 billion years ago.
Yes, exactly.
So I don't know that my mind can make that connection.
Also, let me ask you before we go to phone lines with you. Did you know Paul Vigay?
Oh, yes. It is
tragedy.
Tragedy. Yeah. Paul Vigay was one of the hardest working crop circle researchers in England. All of us have known Paul for years, and it is the saddest thing to learn that on some kind of in a freakish way, he passed on a few days ago.
Yeah. Well, we've lost another great investigator.
Yep.
Let's go to some of the calls. Let's go to JC in Boston, Mass, east of the Rockies. I don't think it's that JC. Hi, JC. JC, you there? Nope, I guess not. Well, let's try west of the Rockies in Las Vegas. We've got Neil. Hey, Neil.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
I got a chance to talk with you when you had Whitley Strieber on.
Okay.
I'm a total believer in UFOs since I had a daylight sighting of a craft. With regards to these lights,
right?
This evening, I read an article on the net about NASA had launched these satellites called Themis in February 2007. Essentially, what they have found is large rips in our magnetosphere, which they claim is allowing just an immense amount of solar radiation to penetrate our atmosphere, charging it with plasma. It's a fascinating and scary article, actually.
I read it, but the concentration of the cracks in the plasma, as I understood it, was at the poles, which would make sense. We're talking about people between January of 2008 and February 15th was the last date of the photographs in Wisconsin, all describing first with their own eyes. This isn't something that's just appearing in photographs. People are seeing the objects. That's what makes them get the cameras. And the objects are uniformly described as looking either round or disc-like with these multiple colors, which is what attracts people's attention to them. And then when they go get binoculars or a camera and they look at this disc-like object or round object that's multicolored light, that's when they see these projections that must be coming from the colored lights that make the patterns in the sky. So we're talking about discrete objects, meaning they are objects that seem to have a confined place in the sky and are in at least six different geographic areas over a year. And so to me, that's completely different from the research work that is going on with the satellites trying to take a look at the Earth's magnetic field around the globe.
Okay, thank you for that. Richard, by the way, sends us another note and says his theory with Tom's planet blew up 65 million years ago in our solar system.
Well, then he's trying to tie that to what essentially was the end of the dinosaurs.
Yes.
In that period. But, I mean, it's a big stretch. It's a big stretch to even prove that the iridium down in the Yucatan, which is dated 65 million years ago, was an impacting asteroid that was responsible. Today, that's accepted, but it was a big leap back a few years ago. So to say that whatever came into the Yucatan was directly related to the explosion of a planet out there, I think is just a huge stretch.
Do you think the research is going to continue to try to find out where this stuff comes from?
Well, it is ongoing.
I mean, they're not going to stop.
Oh, no. Dr. Lewis is working. Cardiff University is working after he presented the paper in August 2008 in San Diego. He has other people in the optical engineering area that are interested. So
why do you think it takes him so long?
Well, George, the pinkish water is there. I held a vial in my hands. I looked at some of it under a microscope. I looked at the photographs of they're trying to penetrate to take out stuff to look for DNA when I was at Cardiff and heard about all the difficulties that they were having with what they were terming as cell walls at Cardiff University. They described them as being thick and resistant to penetration.
Okay, next up.
They have DNA or not. They've got to penetrate into those cells adequately to get whatever is in the interior. And that is apparently that's one of the puzzles about how to deal with these things.
Let's go to Maui in Hawaii. Thomas, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us, Thomas.
Greetings, George. How are you today?
Good. I'm doing great. Thanks.
A little rainy out here today. My question is to Linda. I was on a lecture scene for a few years, and I met her. She came over to the Big Island a couple years ago. You made a statement about how, I don't know, a few years ago when all the animals in the United States were dying, mainly the elk.
About the 12,900 years where they're trying to tie it through the nanodiamond discovery to the possible impact of cometary pieces on the northern hemisphere.
Right, but there was like herds and herds of elk dying all over the United States.
Yes, in Montana especially.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that they were dying of some kind of bacteria from the ground that they were eating.
Okay, so scrap my nanodiamond.
Yes, come back to this century.
Modern.
Right, yeah. Right. A few years ago. I guess it was about maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
All right.
The reason why I drove across the United States and I stopped in Idaho and I was at the hot springs there and I met the head doctor there and his girlfriend. We got into talking. He was called in to do testing on the elk that died, but at the same time, there was herds of deer dying, and nobody even mentioned that the deers were dying all over, and this was in Idaho.
And probably of the same thing, I would take it.
Well, the herds of elk were basically, like she was saying, they were up in the area of Montana. There was different areas, but it was like all across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, because she was talking about the bats, and then we're talking about bacteria, disease, and different things. And there's a lot of stuff going on because I grew up in Jersey, but I was there when the bird flu started. I was working for the phone company, and I was up on the poles, and I saw hundreds of birds on all the roofs wherever I was working. And it took 2 or 3 years after that before they even mentioned the word bird flu. I'm just wondering if it's any kind of relation between all of them. I mean, and when we talk about the laboratories doing testing, if the government released all the files and documents they had, they'd be able to test in a greater way and understand what's really happening. But, like, getting back to the main question is, like, the bats dying and different things right now, and they all do affect what happens to us as far as, like, bugs becoming super populated. But did you really have any connection? Do you think there is any connection between all of them?
Well, I think that the elk and the deer problem, as I recall, there was a question about whether it was related to the prion disease. Like there is a prion disease that causes the mad cow syndrome. There is a prion disease known as scabies or scabies. There are various issues and questions about some of the animal die-offs, if they involve shaking legs and weakness, that it may or may not be prion disease. I think that was a question in that elk die-off, but I don't recall ever learning a definitive explanation. When you go to bird flu, you're in the virus territory, not prions. And it is called the H5N1 virus. That's what was that first emerged in Hong Kong a decade ago, and that it is so lethal to bird populations that there were reports of like 6,000 types of water birds that died in one area in China within 24 or 48 hours. That's how lethal the H5N1 type virus that causes what is known as bird flu, that is H5N1, and that was making, apparently, or has made jumps from birds or contaminated animals into humans. And the World Health Organization has a ongoing website that keeps track of how many cases have appeared in 20-some countries now of H5N1 and how many people have contracted and died. Fortunately, the number is small in the human population, huge in the bird population. And the big fear is whether or not that H5N1 virus would mutate one day and be able to easily spread among humans in urine, perspiration, or some kind of a contaminant that would then lead to a world pandemic. When it comes to the bees, the amphibians, and the bats, we're into this strange issue of what is happening in the environment that would provoke a fungus that had been there for so long to suddenly become lethal to bats.
Something cropped it up. Something just kicked it into high gear.
Well, if it is this fungus, see, and here's another mystery. When you go to the honeybees, over the last 2 years, it's interesting that both colony collapse disorder and the bat dying really both started at approximately the same time. And in the honeybees, colony collapse disorder, one of the first papers that came out on the bees said that at the University of Pennsylvania and Penn State, where they had sent various aspects of the bees' anatomy for analysis, they were finding so many viruses and bacteria in these poor honeybees that they began to wonder, well, is it a virus? Is it a bacteria? Or is it that the immune system has completely collapsed because of something else and all these bacteria and viruses are getting into the bees? Today, the more likely scenario perhaps, but still not proved, just like they haven't proved anything in the bats, is that it may be those nicotine-based pesticides are what have screwed up the honeybee ability to leave the hives, go out, gather pollen, and make it back to the hive because the nicotine-based pesticides clearly now, in many more tests that have been done in Europe as well, it affects the memory of the honeybee. So they know that, and they know that the symptoms of these complete huge hive disappearances might be linked to that. Well, the bats are going through a strange syndrome in which they are losing their fat tissue, and they have this fungus. It's there. It's on their face and in their ears, but nobody has ever heard of anything like this ever happening before. Well, 2007, is there something that was happening that none of us know yet between 2006 to 2007 globally that would be responsible for colony collapse disorder, bat death, happening, and the strange rise of the chytrid fungus that began attacking amphibians first down in Panama in Central America is where it was first discovered. And there was one scientist who reported she was so doubtful that this could be true, that the that the chytrid fungus was spreading so fast and killing so many amphibians that when she came up with a figure, because she was trying to keep track of it, and it was something like 1,000 miles in a year, she was almost afraid to report and publish it because it didn't seem realistic. How could this chytrid fungus move 1,000 miles, killing all of the amphibians in its path in a year? Well, today we know that the chytrid fungus is now in California and various parts of the United States. The chytrid fungus is killing amphibians in Australia, in South America, Central America, Mexico, the United States, and who knows where else. And that is relatively recent, meaning you have to go back to around 1998, which is still only a decade ago.
And how do we know it's not causing this respiratory illness that's all over the place all the time? People are sick constantly lately, Linda.
It's a really interesting question because I've always been an allergy person. My family all had allergies, pollen and mold. And every week it seems like something new is coming. I have never myself been so challenged with almost 365 days a year now what appears to be allergies. Right now, the juniper is releasing pollen in Albuquerque, and it's just, I'm on allergy medicine, but I mean, it's horrendous. Well, but you can say, well, if I only had to live with an allergy 2 weeks in the spring and 2 weeks in the fall or winter. But I would say that so many people that I know I've had this discussion with, once upon a time we had seasons for allergies. Now it seems like it's 365. There is something causing people to cough and choke and sneeze all the time.
And I remember growing up in Detroit as a kid, people would say, hey, you know, we're moving to Phoenix because it's better. We don't get asthma. I don't think that's the case anymore. No. It's all over the place.
That's right. It is. And our Earth is changing. It's changing rapidly. Whatever is the source and the cause is not any longer as relevant as the Earth is changing. The Antarctic is melting in places faster than any place on record. We know that the North Pole is going to be open to ships that will save time on getting ships around the world. I'm talking about the summer months, but it means that we are now entering a brand new world when the Arctic remains open for months during the summer, and that is already here.
All right. When we come back in just a moment, we'll finish up with the rest of your calls with our conversations with Linda. Her website is earthfiles.com, and you can send her emails as well at earthfiles@earthfiles.com, and you can email me anytime you want at george@coasttocoastam.com as well. Tomorrow on our program, we will have Rosemary Ellen Guiley join us. She's got a brand new Frank's Box where she claims she's communicating with the spirit world. We'll also talk with Rosemary about dreams and have her interpret some of your dreams as well before we go into open lines. And then I'm catching an early morning flight to Vancouver, British Columbia for a major event Saturday before coming back Sunday, hosting Coast to Coast Sunday night. I'm George Norrie, back with Linda Moulton Howe and your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, are you a member of Streamlink yet? If you're not, you might want to join for just pennies a day. You'll be able to get downloads and podcasts and just have some fun with Coast to Coast AM. To subscribe, simply go to our website and click the Streamlink link, and then there you are. We'll be back in a moment with Final Conversations with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back at you now with Linda Moulton Howe. Let's go to Hank, east of the Rockies, who happens to be in Wisconsin. Hi, Hank.
Hi, George.
Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Hank.
Linda, earlier in the show, you were talking about a John Smith from Wisconsin that was observing some strange lights in the sky, and I've had some similar experiences.
Really?
About 2 years ago, I started noticing this extremely bright object in the western sky that's always in the same exact spot every night. It's there about 10 hours every night, and once in a while it flashes white, green, and red colors really fast, and occasionally it almost looks like it's breathing. It kind of expands and contracts.
But have you photographed this or looked at it through binoculars or a telescope to make sure it's not a planet or a star?
Yes, through binoculars.
And what did you see?
What made me realize it wasn't a planet or star is every once in a while there would be about two or three balls that seemed to come out of the side of this object, and they would spin around this object extremely fast.
Hmm.
Then they'd go back in the object, and every once in a while this object would disappear, then reappear a couple minutes later.
Were you able to get any photograph?
No.
And where are you when you were seeing this geographically?
I was right in front of my house. It's in the western sky.
But where? What town?
Wausau, Wisconsin.
How far is that from Elmwood?
I'm not sure. I've never even heard of that city before.
Well, you know where the Twin Cities are, and you know where Eau Claire is?
I'm a bit northeast of that.
Okay. Elmwood is right between, almost, a little south, but sort of midway between the Twin Cities and Eau Claire.
Okay.
But a little south of a midline. So you would be north of there, but in that general area.
Yes.
And you say 2 years ago you started seeing what you thought were balls coming out of the object?
Yes.
And anything current?
Still happens to this day. Every day I see this object.
You've got to have a camera by you. Grab one, Hank.
Don't have a digital camera, but I have a cheap disposable camera.
Well, you know what? They may work, too.
Well, what I'm puzzled by is you're saying that for 2 years, two times 365 days, nearly 1,000 days, that you have been seeing this light every single night?
Yep.
And you have never taken a photograph or gotten somebody to videotape it?
No, I haven't.
Well, okay, we got to start now, right, Linda?
Well, it's very peculiar. I certainly wish that you would get somebody who is an amateur astronomer to join you as a reality check
yes.
on the object.
Absolutely, and get some pictures. And how do people get video to you, Linda? Just send them to you?
Well, people send video to me on DVDs through the mail. If it's short, sometimes as MPGs through email attachments. But the best way is if you have really good video is to put it on a DVD and mail it to me. And my mailing address and everything is at earthfiles.com. That is my website, and every email I would exchange has all of my contact information. So for those of you out there who think that you may be seeing something occasionally that is strange, always remember that the first thing is to try to get a reality check with an amateur astronomer. And if it passes that as not being something that's a planet or a star, like John Smith, he does use telescopes. He is aware of the fact that the skies change with the seasons and planets and stars, and he's got a light that since November, when it was first seen through February, keeps coming up at exactly the same place, low on the horizon in the sky, and then he's getting these photographs. And that doesn't make sense for a normal astronomical body.
Next up, let's go to Atlantic City, New Jersey. Tom, thanks for holding. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Linda. You know, I've lived here on the East Coast now all my life, and I've seen so many things die off. Marine life, the bees have me concerned because I hear reports that they're not regenerating. And around where I live, there's a lot of fields, let's say, with buttercups and stuff like that, where you would see bees constantly feeding. You don't see that anymore.
Right.
I would just like your opinion, Linda, on how you feel about, did you realize, you've heard about the, we had this bird kill off about a month ago here in New Jersey.
Right.
Okay. Now, they sprayed something or fed something to these birds to kill them off, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Now, where does that residual stuff go?
It's a very, very good question. I think that the toxicity of this planet from pesticides and poisons is becoming a huge problem, and most of us don't understand it and what the links are. But there is another issue on the East Coast. I got an email today reminding me of what I experienced myself when I lived in Philadelphia. I moved into a place in Bucks County in March of 1993, and in June of that year, there were millions of fireflies. I was just stunned. I would go out at sunset and just sit and watch the surreal beauty of all of these beautiful insects in the air lighting up, and they would go up into the trees, and during June at 2 o'clock in the morning, they would be in the trees and in the grass. It was really like something out of Walt Disney. Hmm. By 1995, it was only 2 years later, where they always, I had been told they always came around the first week of June, and when I was there the first 2 years, it was always June 7th that they showed up. By 1995, they were late and way reduced in numbers. And the next year, I called the local agricultural extension office, and I explained what I had seen, and now it was like there were hardly any fireflies at all, and they said, yeah, we're getting a lot of calls about this, and we don't know. It could be seasonal. Well, I just got an email today from somebody who was telling me that where they hadn't noticed fireflies in the central, south central region of the United States, that they don't see fireflies there anymore. And if you go to Philadelphia and you go to where these gorgeous places were about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. they aren't there. So something has happened to the fireflies, and we don't hear about it as much as the bats and the bees, because the bees are so important to pollination and to growing crops and to producing honey. And the bats are the biggest insect eaters there are. But the fireflies have also been disappearing.
Let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut. Bill, take it away.
Yes. Hi, George. Hi, Linda. Hey, I have a fantastic question. You talked about the Mars Science Laboratory. Let me cut to the chase, something that Richard C. Hoagland is on. It's on his mind as well, humans on Mars. I have a faster and quicker way to get humans to Mars in light of the economic situation we're in, using a certain spacecraft that's already 70 to 80% built and paid for already and in space already as the major bus. The major spacecraft to go to Martian orbit. That's the International Space Station. Why can't NASA take the ISS, add the appropriate amount of rocket engines to it to get to Martian orbit and then later get back to Earth orbit where you'd study the Martian samples? And then most importantly, you would have to add two or three Martian Habitat-Landers connected to the ISS where you'd land on Mars. And coincidentally, as of this year, the ISS will be able to maintain six astronauts, which is coincidentally the number usually talked about for the first mission to Mars. So you have a situation where the spacecraft is already almost completely built and paid for, and you have the other device that NASA uses to get sweat and urine into water. Added that with hydroponic gardens and all the consumables needed, we could get to Mars before George Norrie, Richard Hoagland, and I are in our 80s.
Let me ask you a question. How would you propel the ISS from orbit around Earth out into space and make it orbit around Mars?
Well, if you had the appropriate amount of rocket engines with the right fuel and a fuel that could last the two-year mission, could you get it, I assume, to Martian orbit and deorbit it around Mars and eventually get it out of Martian orbit, which would be easier with the lighter gravity, and back to Earth orbit? Is that possible?
Well, my guess would be that there are a lot of NASA scientists who would give a thousand reasons why this wouldn't work. I will be going to the Lunar and Planetary Institute conference in Houston in late March, and there are going to be all kinds of discussions on the Mars Science Laboratory, which is our next best adventure for exploring Mars in a way that at least the scientist thinks is feasible.
Linda, would you go to Mars if they offered it to you, if they offered you a trip?
That I could go in a safe vehicle.
Yep, and come back, but it could take 2 or 3 years.
I would absolutely love to explore this solar system and the universe.
Still promise to file your reports every month?
Wouldn't that be something?
Oh,
it would take would take a while to get communication.
Well, but we'd set it up right. You know our engineering staff. They'd do it right. Let's go to Rochelle, Illinois. First-time caller is Andrew. Andrew, you're on with Linda Moulton Howe.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Good,
Andrew. Started listening to the show. I love it. My friend Bill turned me on to it. It's awesome.
Super. Well, thanks for joining us.
Surprised I got through, though. But I was just wanting to say, I've been noticing a lot lately that the birds around here, just giant flocks have been flying north lately, and it's just really kind of weirding me out.
Meaning earlier than you would normally see birds flying north.
Well, I mean, it's been happening for a few months now.
Well, there are changes, I know.
Strange changes.
In bird habits. There have been reports that have been written up about the fact that there's no question that ecosystems are changing and that the Earth life that can move is moving. Some things are moving higher altitudes and some things are moving like further north. And a lot of it has to do with changes in temperature that I don't know where we'll call it the static came from this last year about, oh, the Earth is cooling. There's no question that there was an El Nino in the Pacific, which is now a La Nina in the Pacific that is now declining, that would have contributed to colder temperatures in parts of the Northern Hemisphere. But there's no question everywhere that we are having temperature changes on the Earth, generally going up in many, many places. Drought is increasing. Fires are increasing. And the animals that can move are moving, and that certainly would include the habits of birds. And as we keep getting deeper into this century, the question is going to be, how much more rapidly are these temperature zone changes going to shift? And then when do they begin to affect the plants that can't move? And this morning on the local radio station that does issues in New Mexico, there was an interview with a scientist who was talking about how they have now discovered in certain parts of New Mexico in the mountains that what once upon a time used to be indigenous healthy trees, they are dying. And that trees that were planted just in the last few years are thriving. They're different species. And that they are so surprised by the death of what they thought was the older species that should keep going. And all of it boiled down to is that drought conditions are forcing even trees that used to grow here into perhaps illness and death. So there's change everywhere.
Linda, on your next report, please make one of these stories, the dwindling water supplies in Las Vegas. Critical story. Unbelievable.
Oh, and it's not just Las Vegas.
No, it's all over.
It's everywhere.
Yep. That would be great. As a matter of fact, you're right. Atlanta, Los Angeles will have problems.
Yeah.
It is everywhere. Let's go to Vancouver, Washington, west of the Rockies. Kevin. What was that? Kevin, you there? Kevin, are you there? There you go.
Okay, hi. Sorry
good.
About that.
That's right.
I heard about these symbols. I was on the internet, and one of the persons that was filming these was explaining how he did it. And what you do is you put your camera in the night mode, and what it does is it slows down the shutter speed. So all you have to do is focus your camera on a light in the sky, like maybe a star or something. And what happens is you end up getting those symbols. He was explaining how he did it. He put it up, and everybody thought it was a UFO and an alien and all this kind of stuff. But But all you do is put it in night mode. Anybody can try it in a little experiment.
Fascinating.
And when you look at the video, you could not tell the difference between those symbols and the ones that Linda Moulton Howe's talking about. I was wondering how we could get on Coast to Coast or have Linda do a special report so that people will think that they're unexplained.
Well, send us some info. Send it to me and also send it to Linda at earthfiles.com.
Are you talking exclusively about video?
I don't know where he is now, Linda, but he was having some phone problems or something. But we'll see what happens.
See, the part that he's leaving out are the human eyewitnesses that include Leroy Gayton down in Dublin.
The constable.
He saw with his own eyes. His wife saw with his own eyes. The guy in Empire, Ohio, they see the light coming off of the object. That's what provokes them to take the photograph.
Linda,
the object is functioning first before anybody gets the camera.
This planet in this universe, this vastness of where we live is still high strangeness, isn't it?
In every direction, and more mysteries every day, from black holes and down to will they be able to get the Hadron Collider operating this spring, and if so, what's going to happen there? That's another big story.
Yeah, it's going to gobble us up like Pac-Man.
I don't think so myself. I don't think so at all.
I hope you're right.
What they're going to try to probe is basically, if they can, to get back as close to the conditions of the beginning of this universe as possible. And what will come out of there in terms of what we learn is huge, and they may have insights into dark energy and dark matter.
We'll see you next month, Linda. Linda Moulton Howe always does a phenomenal job. For Kara Scoburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.